This is Scott Becker with the Becker Group Women's Leadership Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by the CEO of AGTC, Sue Washer. Sue and AGTC, she'll tell us all about it. Sue, let me ask you to take a moment and introduce yourself.
Well, thank you, Scott, for having me today. I'm really thrilled to join this podcast. As you said, I'm CEO of AGTC, a position that I've held for over a decade now. I have a background in biochemistry and business development and have worked in large pharmaceutical companies such as Abbott Labs and Eli Lilly, and really found my calling working for a developing biotech like AGTC. And what I really find thrilling about our mission is that we're working to develop products for patients with completely unmet needs, for patients that have no alternatives to improve their quality of life. And we have a specific focus in ophthalmology. And these are patients that are born with genetic deficiencies that cause them to have very poor visual function, which in many cases gets worse and worse over time and really affects the quality of their life, their educational opportunities, and their opportunities for work. So it's a really exciting space to be in, and we're thrilled to be developing these products for patients.
And so you're the president and CEO, leading sort of biotech company, gene therapy company. Tell us a little bit about your career journey and how you grew into this role, how you grew into CEO and president of a great biotech firm.
So as I mentioned earlier, I do have a background in science. So I got a degree in biochemistry. And out of school, I went to work for Abbott Labs in the diagnostics division. So in that division of Abbott Labs, we were developing tests for different viral infections. So that's how I got my first exposure to virology and what viruses are and how they work and how you test for them and how they affect the human body. And I was really very, very interested in, I've always been kind of a science geek, always liked technology. But what I found through my years at Abbott is that there was somewhat of a disconnect between how scientists thought and what was possible in the lab and what the marketing people, what the commercials people, what patients wanted, and how those groups of people could talk to each other. And so I thought after a period of time that what I wanted to do was get a business education to be able to understand that side of how you develop healthcare products and then act as some sort of translator between the two. So after I got my business degree, I went to work for Eli Lilly in sales and marketing, and that's where I really did something completely different and really tried to learn the other side of the business. What are the healthcare providers thinking about? What are patients thinking about? How do we get these products delivered to patients? And it was really then coming to AGTC that I was able to put back together those two sides of my experience and really look at new product development, dive back into technology and cutting edge methodologies of developing treatments for patients, but then also have that experience from the business side to apply as well.
A great combination of sort of that engineering background with the business background and thinking and the biotech background. Talk about the big trends today that you see in biotech gene therapy. Seems like moving faster than ever. Talk to us a little bit, inform our audience. What are you sort of seeing? What are some of the big trends?
So I do think you're absolutely right, Scott, in that things are changing very quickly. And the gene therapy space specifically, both gene therapy and cell therapy, which combined are really regenerative medicine. So the idea of really understanding the root cause of disease and going after that root cause of disease and affecting the genetics and the cell action itself, I think is becoming more and more important and allows us to really be very specific in the treatments that we develop. And I think what's becoming known and the reason the space has accelerated so much is we've gotten a much better understanding of how to design and construct these products. It's not just a simple matter of kind of throwing the correct gene back in the patient's body. You have to understand how to target to the right cells, how to promote and express the right amount of protein, how to physically deliver your product appropriately, how to manufacture it at scale. And I think over the last 15 to 20 years, that seems like a long time, and I know a lot of folks aren't really aware of how long it takes to develop a technology and a product to be approved for patient treatment. But over the last 15 to 20 years, I think we've garnered just a much better understanding of the complexity and how to look at that complexity and design the products much more appropriately.
So I've seen, at least witnessed, the huge advances in gene therapy related to oncology. Are there similar advances? Where are the areas that we think of as the human diseases or the human areas? Where are the places where gene therapy is making the most impact in your perspective?
So I think that in my particular space, so I particularly work in AAV gene therapy or adeno-associated virus gene therapy, and AAV is a small viral vector that's, you know, many of us in the world have been exposed to AAV, but it doesn't cause any disease. But it's very good at getting into certain cell types, and because it doesn't cause disease, even if it's in its natural state, it provides a great safety margin, which I think is very attractive to those of us working in the space. And I think two products that have been recently approved and are being commercialized in the world, across the world, are really stunning examples of what can be really great about gene therapy space. And one of them is a product to treat an ophthalmology indication. It's a very rare indication, called Leber's congenital amaurosis, but it affects a very small number of patients. But to those patients, it's quite devastating because it means that they have very poor vision and eventually they go completely blind. And this product has been approved in the United States and in many countries throughout the world and is providing just dramatic improvements in these patients' lives, such as they're able to see much better, participate in much wider range of activities, and really it's been very durable from just one treatment. The other product I would point to that just is an example of like the stunning effect that you can have with gene therapy is a product that is now being developed and commercialized by Novartis. And it's a product to treat SMA, which is a very devastating disease that affects kids from the moment they're born. And many of these children previous to this kind of treatment died very early in life before they really got out of their toddler years. And now this product has allowed these kids to be very functional, to walk, which they couldn't possibly do before, not get beyond ventilators, and live much longer and very high quality lives. So that's a stunning example of what the promise of gene therapy is.
Let me ask you another question on gene therapy. You had mentioned some of these approved in the U.S., some of these approved overseas and growth. We've seen some gene therapies approved much quicker in places like Germany than here. Is that just anecdotal, or is that what's the process like for approval, and does it differ dramatically from country to country?
So I think that there was initially a lot of scrutiny of gene therapy products. People were very reasonably concerned about safety of these products that could be long-term, and that once you deliver many of these gene therapies, you can't turn them off. So I think that the hurdle to show safety was appropriately scrutinized. I think in this time, though, people, especially for AAV gene therapy, are quite confident in the long-term safety, even though you still have to develop that data and report it to the agencies. I don't see in my experience that approval in any one country is easier or harder than other countries. I think there have been some kind of anecdotal maybe easier pathways in some Asian countries. But I think overall, there's been a big push from the major countries to do what's called regulatory harmonization, And so to really be more integrated in the hurdles and standards for regulatory approval across several countries.
Thank you. As you look at the next 6 to 12 months, I'm going to ask you two final questions, and thank you, Sue, so much for being with us today. Your top priorities right now, what are the top priorities of the company right now? And then I want to ask you just a couple moments of advice for other biotech leaders.
Yeah, so what's most important to us right now is that we are moving our lead product candidate for an ophthalmology indication, a genetic cause of vision loss, into late-stage clinical development. So what's most critical for us is to get that trial started as soon as possible and to effectively move in a safe manner through the late stages of clinical development so we can get these products to our patients. So that's really our most critical item and job one for us. It's also really exciting. We've been working in this space for a long period of time, and to get to the point where we're starting late stage development and can kind of see the end goal in mind and see being able to get this product to patients is really exciting for us. So that's job one. I think that my piece of advice to leaders in the biotech arena is something that I actually talk about with my peers all the time, and that is if you keep the patients at the forefront of your thoughts and you keep the patient need at the forefront of your thoughts, it will enable you to develop good products. If you're distracted by, you know, how long something is going to take, or the complexity of the clinical trial, or what your financing needs are, you can get distracted. So I think that keeping patient needs in the forefront is what's going to lead you to success.
Let me ask you this. Clinical trials. Obviously, clinical trials are in the news in a way that all lay people know more about clinical trials than they ever have in their entire life because of the COVID clinical trials. In a clinical trial for a drug of the sort that you're talking about, what's the typical amount of people that have to go in that kind of clinical trial? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so for one of the benefits of working in the orphan drug space like we do, so rare disease space, is the clinical trials do tend to be smaller, much smaller than what you're hearing about for the COVID trials. So we typically, in our late stage trials, have 100 patients or less in our trial. Now, the flip side of that is because these are rare diseases, it's hard to find those 100 people. These are diseases that only a few hundred thousand people in the whole country have. So identifying the patients to enter the clinical trial really becomes the hurdle to meet.
Does that usually happen through sort of the leading doctors, leading people in these areas at the great academic medical centers, those people that end up sort of facilitating getting these clinical trial participants, or how does that work?
So it's a combination of two things. One is that in each of these rare diseases, there's usually a handful of people in academic referral centers that are experts, and they've become experts in these rare diseases over their career. And so, yes, that's absolutely important to be connected to those people, to learn about the indications from those people. But equally important is the patient advocacy groups. And patient advocacy groups are usually patient-led or parent-led in the case of diseases that affect young children, that grow up in clusters across the country, across the world, where they're advocating to push for research in these disease areas, to push for awareness in these disease areas, many times lobbying for testing for these types of diseases. So it's equally important for you to be reaching out and interacting with these patient advocacy groups so that you as a drug developer can learn more about the patient journey and what's important to them in product development. And so you can work with them to make awareness about your research and your clinical trials available to all of the different patient groups.
And this is not a Spartan effort. To do this, what's the cost to bring a drug from idea to clinical trials? I mean, for an orphan drug, the cost must be immense to get from point A to point B.
Yeah, it is quite large. The estimates vary widely. I would point not just to the cost, but to the time frame. I think that many people don't understand that from the point of time of when you have an idea about a potential treatment in a specific disease, it can take 8 to 12 years before you have a product that you're ready to ask for regulatory approval of. It is a very long period of time and takes persistence and perseverance and, you know, very strict attention to details. You know, the estimates of how much it costs to develop a drug are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's the cost and the time of development that really drives the expense of the drug rather than the cost of manufacturing. I think that this is a common misconception or misunderstanding. It's, you know, because only, this is another stunning statistic, but only about 8% of all treatments that are originally thought of ever make it to the patient. So 92% of the ideas that researchers and drug companies have for a potential product fail. But we all want to do that research so that 8% becomes successful.
And it's a funnel, because there's really only so many products that even get to, you know, the late stage trials. And then you
Correct.
Sure hope by the point you're at late stage trials that they're successful, the safety and efficacy is shown, so you can get through to actually have a drug that's available for patients to use. So it's really a funnel. Sue, it's an amazing. I did get a chance to work in indirectly the Michigan State background, so I worked hard at that. But I do appreciate you greatly joining us today. I really do. Just magnificent career, and what a professional life you're having, and what an impact you're having on people. So I wish you great luck in getting this drug through this late-stage trial, and we're just excited to keep on following what you're doing at AGTC. Just magnificent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Scott. I've enjoyed it.